yet another episode of Pundit 3 on a Pint. We are three blokes today having an above average football conversation. Joining me on the podcast is Akshat and returning member after a very, very long time, Po. Welcome back, Po. It's great to have you again. Po is back with some very fancy gadgets. Looking very excited and stoked to be recording this episode with us, with the big Po smile on his face.
Let's do this.
Po is ready. So we've had an incredible 2 months of international football with the World Cup, of course, but our focus on this episode is going to be the restart of the Premier League, the league that we talk about most often. And while we were planning to record this episode, we actually realized that throughout this entire season, we've never addressed the top six or the top four race or the title race yet. So that is what we're going to focus on today. We're going to talk about, of course, the big six teams in Newcastle United, who form the top half of the table. And speaking about the top half of the table, just on the precipice of it is Chelsea, who are placed number 10th, which has been a very, very shocking season for me, considering how much money they've spent in the summer transfer window. Of course, they had major restructure within the club, with the ownership itself changing. Had to sack Thomas Tuchel due to personal differences. We've addressed that in our previous episodes. Graham Potter came in, who was probably one of the hottest prospects in English football for a managerial position. And I just want to throw it out there quickly. How do you think Chelsea have fared, and how do you think Potter has fared so far?
When you put it out like that, no, like, Potter has had, how many games has Potter had around, like, roughly around 15 games? So, like, 10 to 15 games, something around those numbers is what I feel.
17 in the Premier League, so, like, around 20, 25.
Oh, okay, but the thing is,
Tuchel didn't even start this season award for the Premier League. That's not possible.
No.
I'm so confused.
Oh, yeah. No, wait. Yeah, I messed up. Yeah, around 15 is right.
Yeah, I think it'll be around 10 to 15, because Tuchel did have a, I think, 5 to 6 game run, yeah. And he
started the season for sure. Yeah.
He was sacked after the second Champions League game, if I'm not mistaken. So, like, around 6-7 games he must have played.
Yeah.
Chelsea have been a mess for a while, you know, like, ever since the whole Roman Abramovich saga, him going, Todd Bowling coming in, the whole summer transfer window where everyone just made a mockery out of Chelsea. Like, they kept every single target out there. Like, Chelsea wanted to put their hands into it. Like, they wanted to have a go at everyone else's transfer tag targets. And we all made fun of them during that phase. And then it was clear they did not have any set ideals on how to go ahead with the transfer market. Because, I mean, even they sacked what's her name? Marina? I don't want to pronounce her last name because
Granitskova, yeah, she left. Marina Granitskova left with Abramovich because she's basically his right hand. So
that's what, like, basically the entire hierarchy of Chelsea, like, had a reshuffle, no? So
I think Petr Cech left too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so those are the three most important positions. And Chelsea were a club that was so ruthless in the transfer market and with their scouting department because of those two, with Marina Granitskova and Petr Cech on the reins.
See, I mean, they've had high-profile hits and misses under Granitskova, and I think now we're seeing way more misses than hits. They've had a very, very significant outlay in the transfer market. And for me, it just kind of reminds me so much of those early days under Ed Woodward, when we were just signing these somehow random people into our team without really much of a thought as to how they'd gel together or what's actually required for the squad. And I feel like that's kind of what Bowley's first transfer window has been. And now continuing on to the winter transfer window, where they've brought in Badiashile, they've brought in Fofana, the striker, they've brought in a youth Brazilian.
Andre Santos or something.
Andre Santos. And
they're also going for Enzo, right?
They're heavily going for Enzo, but then they're in that weird situation where they negotiated everything with the player and told him, yeah, you're coming. But they didn't want to pay the buyout clause, and Benfica's like, bro, what the fuck, why are you talking to a player without even slightly negotiating with us? So it's extremely weird, and I think, like I said, it's not really good business in the transfer window, even though they are spending a significant amount.
Who did they get in the summer? Remind me. I know they got in Sterling, they got in Zakaria.
Aubameyang.
Koulibaly,
right. Wellesley Fofana.
Fofana, yep. Kukurea was...
No, but the thing, that's what I was getting at. That's what I was getting at. Like, their entire transfer window was geared towards what they thought Tuchel needed. And then they kicked Tuchel out within, like, a couple of games in. And they bring in somebody called Potter. And they don't give, like, he's not had a chance at, like, having a shot at his own transfer market yet. But he has all this deadwood that, like, Tuchel would have preferred. And I don't know if Potter would have preferred the same people. Like, look at the way recently, the other game, like, not sure, I think it was the FA Cup or the game against City, I think this was, where they bought in Auba, like, as a substitute in the 4th or 5th minute due to an injury. Yeah, and then they kicked him off. Yeah, and they subbed him off, like, later on, like, in the 60th or 70th minute.
67th minute, yeah.
So, that's...
Let's talk about Aubameyang, who came in to replace Lukaku. And he's replaced Lukaku exactly, because Lukaku is not touching the ball and Auba is not touching the ball either for Chelsea. I think he was averaging like maybe 12 or 13 touches through the game, which is like absolutely appalling. And then we had Lukaku last season who didn't touch the ball at all for I think one entire half, which was a record. So Chelsea are really facing a problem in that number 9 situation. They've chopped and changed so much, and now it's pretty much I think Kai Havertz who's going to be playing that number 9 role, because Auba is really not contributing. And Auba is that kind of player, man, like if he doesn't score goals, then he's actually not doing anything in the game, you know.
The thing is, like, throughout the years everyone can overlook like the low involvement during the remaining parts of the game, because he had those, like, he had that magic boots, like he could turn those chances into goals. And now he's sort of lost that. No, I wouldn't say he's not lost the ability to do it, but he's declined. Like, it's not at the same rate that he can score the goals in. No, like, he was always one of those strikers who needed high chances to get, like, a couple of goals in. Like, he was not one of those with, like, you give me, like, one or two chances and I'll convert them. He always needed high chances, but high number of chances. But the thing is, even that is reducing now. The way his conversion rate has declined over the past 3 or 4 years is kind of, like, keeping up with his age right now. And there is no involvement whatsoever in the remaining parts of the game, like in terms of build up play or any other thing. Like, he's your typical number 9, like fox in the box kind of a striker. So you can't overlook that now, right now. Like, it's similar to like an aging Ronaldo, but like 50% or 40% when you compare him to that.
And scoring goals has clearly been Chelsea's problem so far in the season. There's that famous stat now which is going out that Haaland has scored more goals in the Premier League than Chelsea, which is shockingly true, because Chelsea have now played 17 games and scored just 20 goals. Ooh. And that kind of a return is just not going to get you in the top four, which I mean, seemingly right now, I think it's quite easy to write them off. They're 10th and literally almost half the season's over. So I don't really see them as being a challenge to top four this season.
And it's not just that, Akshat. It's not that they're not converting the chances. It's that they're not creating the chances itself. I think they're the second lowest ranked team in terms of big chances in a match, with only Southampton or Wolves behind. I forget one of the two. But their attacking stats are absolutely appalling, which is weird because you have so much talent in that team with Sterling, Pulisic, Havertz, Mason Mount, Ziyech, Reece James. A lot of injuries too.
Yeah, but to be fair, they do have like a shocking number of injuries as well at this point in the season. In the City game, both Pulisic and
Sterling
came off with injuries, adding to the long list. Broya, Mount, and I mean, they have a huge, it's almost an 11 they can fill. Chilwell, Reece James, Fofana, Kante, I mean, even Edouard Mendy, all of them out. So it's a very difficult situation for Potter, but we definitely knew that there's going to be a very difficult period for him to adjust. It was just not going to be possible with, like, as Po said at the very start, like, with the amount of change happening at that club, it was very unlikely that they'd have a stable start to the season. So they're going to have to treat this season as kind of a write-off. they are still in the Champions League, so maybe they can get like some good results over there. But yeah, it doesn't look like they're going to be qualifying for the top four or even in the shout, to be honest.
Do you think Potter lasts the season like this?
I hope so.
If it goes on like this.
I hope so. I mean, Chelsea deserve whatever's coming for them if they keep changing, chopping and changing managers like this man. Like, they don't deserve any good thing in life if they keep doing this. Like, Potter deserves a good period of like at least a year or a year and a half. Like, get a couple of transfer windows in. Try to build his own stamp on his squad.
Was this on your bingo card? When Bo starts showing bias.
It's not bias, bud. It's not bias.
For listeners actually who don't know, like, we don't hear it as much often on the pod, but we speak to Po almost every day, and he's actually one of the saltiest people I've ever seen in my life when it comes to football. This man is so salty. He loves it when, like, Spurs fans are in agony or Spurs are losing. It gives him immense joy. I think he loves... Spurs losing more than he likes Arsenal winning. It's come to that point now.
that's sort of like borderline there, and I think Arsenal trumps it. But this though, like, I would say this for any club, like, regardless of the person, even for Spurs, like, even though I'd love it for them to be in misery, but I don't believe in this chopping and changing of managers so often, because you gotta give them time. Like, the other day Pep also had an interview recently, you know, where he spoke about like how you need to like at least give them a few transfer windows to settle in, like, put their imprints on the team and, like, get the way they want them to play.
Yeah. We'll jump straight up four places and talk about Liverpool, who are placed sixth. There are 28 points, seven away from the top four. They've had a very, very mixed run because they started off pretty badly. Then they had that burn with absolute battering. It looked like they were coming back. And then again, few set of injuries pull them back a little bit again. That team looks very run down, to be honest. Sadio Mane was a big hole, which I think they underestimated the kind of void that Mane would leave, which they just haven't been able to fill up.
I think Liverpool are hit with multiple problems at the same time, which has kind of just crumbled them. One being, of course, the Mane factor missing, which is, I mean, he finished second in the Ballon d'Or race. So he's literally, over the last year, you can say the second best footballer on the planet. Any team would miss that, no matter how good your replacement may be in Diaz, and now Nunez, and now Gakpo. They're loading up on those forward positions. It's insane. But that was the first factor. The second one, which I think is more important, is their midfield. It just can't sustain the kind of energy it used to command earlier on. And Liverpool, I mean, they always used to be about that, you know, in the first half an hour of a game, you're already 2-0 down. You know, like, they just come out of the gates with so much energy, press you down, hound you, and almost shock you with the amount of energy they come out with. And they're not able to sustain that with this midfield anymore. Henderson is not able to sustain that. Fabinho has had an almost shocking transition in terms of form. Keita has not lived up to expectations. Thiago
is injury prone. Harvey Elliott is too young.
Yeah, Harvey Elliott again seems very raw. So that midfield issue has definitely led to them being lower than they'd like to be. And I think third is the fact that Van Dijk has not really hit that form he had before the ACL injury. And Van Dijk, being the best defender in the world, covered a lot of their weaknesses, especially with Trent Alexander-Arnold never being the best defender. But now it just seems so much more obvious, right? Because you don't have Van Dijk protecting you. Even today, I mean, in the FA Cup game against Wolves, which finished 2-2, that second goal which Wolves scored, it was just like some really strange and weird defending where Trent tried to step up and he just got caught in no man's land. And there are so many moments like that I've seen already this season from Trent. And Van Dijk can't bail him out anymore because it doesn't look like he has that same quote-unquote aura around him where it just seemed like, yeah, fuck, you're not going to get any goals past me. And I think that's probably a combination of these is why Liverpool are suffering this season.
Also, it feels like...
I mean, the Van Dijk factor is... Sorry, go ahead, Bo.
No, also, I was going to say that also this feels like that this is sort of like a transition period for them. You know, like Liverpool used to be this team that had immense strength, speed, stamina, coupled with their incredible like technical ability. You know, like they could like kill you with one of those chances, one or two chances. Like you don't have to give them a lot of chances to like concede goals. But now it just seems like they've gone past that stamina and strength and speed requirements to just having insane technical ability. And although this is like something that is totally opposite of what Klopp usually does, like, and the way he loves to play, like, they have incredible players in their midfield now in terms of Thiago and Harvey Elliott who have crazy technical ability, but they're not the same people, like, who can keep it up for 90 minutes, like Akshat said, like, keep up that high intensity and high pressure for 90 minutes. So I feel like Klopp is kind
that
of...
That was Gini and Fabinho for them. Like in the seasons that they've been successful, Wijnaldum, Fabinho, Henderson, that midfield was very strong.
So it kind of feels like Klopp is transitioning into a different kind of play style. Although I don't get why, because this is not like what he has shown throughout the years. Like, so I'm not sure where they're going or what he's trying to do or if they've actually fallen off a cliff.
Yeah. Another talking point is the striker that they've gotten who... Akshat and I call a donkey, which is Darwin Nunez.
I mean,
he's so weird. Like,
he's entertaining.
He's like this chaotic equalizer in Liverpool's front line. They need him, but they don't need him. You know, it's like that.
Dude, like, in all parts of the pitch, apart like outside the penalty box, he is like a reincarnation of R9, bro. He's like the best footballer I've ever seen in my life. And then he steps into that penalty box and he turns into the worst footballer I've ever seen in my... Bro, it's the most baffling mystery, bro. I'm thankful that he exists. It's just so entertaining to watch as a neutral.
This is like a kid with too much energy, you know? Like, you don't know where the kid is going to run around and put that kind of energy. I mean, but did you guys see yesterday's goal, like, against Wolves, though? Like, that was a beautiful finish. I mean, it seems like if you give him time to think and let him ponder inside the box, he's going to mess up. Like, that's the kind of a person he is. Like, you give him those instantaneous, like, you force him to make a decision, you force his hand. I think he's good at that sense.
Yeah, but he's there's no doubt how dangerous he is, because he creates a fuckload of chances both for himself and for others around him. But man, you do not want him in that penalty area. I don't know.
That's what I'm saying, like a chaotic neutral. Like, he's important to create the chances, he misses them too, but he creates them. Like,
you don't know what you're gonna get out of him.
Yeah.
Like, as an opposing player, I definitely wouldn't want to go up against him, because you never know what you're going to get. Like, he might skin your ass, or like, you might be laughing on the floor looking at the fuck up he's done.
It's like when he's dribbling at you, right? In your mind as a defender, you'll be like, Ronaldo or Welbeck. And then it's a pure 50-50 chance, okay? Like, either he's going to Ronaldo you and get past you and score, or he's going to Welbeck and like trip on his own feet or something. And that's just what Nunez is.
It's awesome. I love it.
He's one of the Liverpool players that I actually adore because of the kind of entertainment that he gives me while, like, I'm just laughing. It's a comedy show plus a good game of football, you know. On one side, you have Salah doing Salah things, and then the ball comes to Nunez, and wow, beautiful. Love it. Yeah, let's move up. 5 points distance between Liverpool and Spurs, even though Liverpool have played a game lesser, is Tottenham, who again have had a very mixed season. And I think we can say this for most of the teams because of like the topsy-turviness of the season, the injuries, and you know, having a World Cup in between and stuff like that. But Antonio Conte recently came out and said that, I don't know what you guys expected, because I've always been saying that this team is not going to challenge for the title, but you kept saying it, and now I'm just telling you that this team again is not challenging for the title. I really don't like managers who come out and say this, you know. It's just something that triggers me for some reason.
I can respect a man going after that severance package, because I know what's up. I know what Conte really wants. He wants to get fucking fired, and he wants that sweet, sweet severance
pay. Yeah, I mean, who'd want to be associated with Spurs longer than 2 years, man? Like, come on. Even Conte's had enough. But
Poe is a menace, bro. He's a menace.
Whatever listeners are hearing right now, just know that you can choose to ignore it completely. What? Because Poe is extremely biased in this situation.
Come on, man. No, I have like valid points about Spurs as well. Like, you guys continue, I'll pitch in.
No, but actually, why don't you go ahead and talk about what you think how the Spurs season has gone.
You know, actually, just talk about Spurs, Poe. I'm going to sit back and listen to this and enjoy it.
No, I'm not going to be like, I'm going to take the high ground and be like as neutral as I can, okay? So, thing is, like, even Conte came out and admitted that, like, it was a miracle that they qualified for the top four last season. No, like, it is true, but because they kind of did overachieve then. I'm talking about, like, come on, man. Like, I'm not making fun of them. Don't laugh.
Bro, go ahead.
With that squad, no, like, making top four is a good thing. Like, they've over relied on two people, although they've gotten replacements in their attack in Richarlison. Dejan Kulusevski, and they have those people around them, but then it's sort of like they've put their chips all in like those two bags of Harry Kane and Son, where now it seems like one of them is kind of starting to decline, and it seemed like they put their like eggs in the basket thinking that, okay, I'm going to rely on these two to carry us forward for at least another 2-3 years, hoping that they'd sustain that form that they had over the past few years. And it seems like Son's giving away right now. Like, although he's had injuries, and then now he's wearing with a face mask, and he says he can't see properly, and he wears it for his family and shit. But I don't care about the reasons. He's declining, man. But like, and Kane is still Kane.
Just to add here, he scored just 3 goals this entire season in the Premier League.
And that was all in one game.
Yeah.
In 145 minutes of football, he came on in the second half and scored that hat trick against Leicester.
That was against Leicester, I think.
Yeah.
And Kane is still Kane, but Kane is still Kane. Like, he's banging in those goals, and it's sort of under the radar this season because of that robotic monster out there in Manchester, and no one's noticing the goals that Kane is doing, right? Like, Kane is scoring right now. It's quite a good, like, it's at a good rate of scoring.
I cannot believe Poe is talking something nice about Kane, because having a conversation. Do you remember this conversation?
I have my ulterior motives, okay? Like, I had a dream last night.
Okay.
I had a dream last night. I'm going to say it on the podcast. Okay. You know, we're looking for a striker. I would pay big bucks. I'd throw on all my savings to see that happen, even though I despise the dude. Like, just to see the tears in Spurs people. Like, imagine our own Sol Campbell moment in this generation in post-COVID era. Bring it, man. So, like, I'm trying to hype Kane up. So, that is part of the reason.
You want Kane to sign for Arsenal.
Yeah, like, do a Sol Campbell. Like, just come out in the press conference with a big smile and say, like, suck it, Spurs, bring it, I'm home. I'm here to win trophies finally. And lead us to the title.
Okay, nice. Nice.
I have nothing to add.
I don't even know how to react to that, bro.
Imagine the tears, but, like, it's sort of sad also. I don't know if, like, that is sort of like a wish of mine. But, yeah, coming back to Spurs, no. Kane is the only one pulling them forward. Kulusevski had, like, an amazing, like, second half of the season last year, like, when he came on for Spurs, like, when he joined Spurs. Now he's sort of, like, dwindled. He's doing well. He's a damn good player.
Yeah, his goal assist contribution is pretty high.
But the other dude that they signed, Richarlison, no, like, I know people have been saying that this is a big hit.
They don't utilize him.
Yeah, I feel that people say that he's a big hit, but I don't know why though. Like, he hasn't done much for Spurs. He was amazing in the World Cup, but like for Spurs, he hasn't done shit yet properly.
He's injured too now, right?
Right now he is, but I do think that the way he played for Brazil, it kind of shows that maybe his best position is the number 9. And at Spurs, you're just not getting that number 9. And for good reason. Fucking Kane is better. There's no doubt about it. But he's not going to play in his best position, which is kind of sad, seeing someone of his talents not being able to play there. But I mean, I agree with everything Poe said. They have tended to rely on the Kane and Son partnership producing for them, and that hasn't produced for them at the same volume. I think Conte, with the system he plays with five at the back, he needs quality defenders, and I don't think the board has backed him with that. They have spent a lot, but they haven't really got him the defenders he needs. He has Perisic, yes, but that right wing back spot is always very dicey.
I don't get why they don't play, like why he doesn't like to play Jed Spence over there, or like give him even a single chance.
So from what I understand, Poe, is that Jed Spence was one of those signings which the board made and Conte didn't want.
He's an amazing prospect, but he played awesome for Middlesbrough.
He is a great prospect, but we know what Conte is, dude. Conte is the guy, he takes ready players and he plays with them. He's not really the manager he's not the Poch, for example, you know, who's going to nurture a player and get him playing well. He's like, if you're not good enough, then sit on the bench. Or like not even on the bench.
Who are the other options? You have Doughty and what's the other? Emerson Royal. When you have those two options, I'd close my eyes.
Royal is not a real footballer.
Yeah, I'd close my eyes and I'd give the freaking captain's armband to Jed Spence and ask him to play for that team, man. Like, why would you play Emerson Royal up front ahead of that kid? Like, you have such a good prospect with you and you're going to fuck it up.
Those are the two. I think his winning backs are the most important position for a Conte team to function properly, and he doesn't have that, but he has a solid number 9 in Harry Kane, who's tiding them through result after result, and I think that's the trend that's going to continue. But I agree with Poe. I don't think Conte lasts for very long, not because he gets fired, but because he would want to leave.
Yeah, I don't think he's gonna stay. I think his contract expires this summer too, so yeah. I don't think he's gonna want to.
He's trying to get that 20 mil savings package before it runs out, huh, Akshar?
I'm telling you, bro, he's a man after my heart, bro. Go after that money.
No, but I'm sure the severance packages will be on a pro rata basis, right? Based on how long you have left on your contract. So
what, bro? He's going to get paid for not working. That is more preferable than getting paid for working.
It's never going to be that Pochettino or Mourinho type of severance package. I don't think we'll ever see that again.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move ahead. Next up, United are above Spurs, but we're going to first talk about Newcastle. Newcastle have played 18 games, they're on 35 points. And man, they've really turned up this season with Eddie Howe. We've been on this pod, like, I think the general consensus is that everyone over here is a fan of Eddie Howe and what he did with Bournemouth, right? And Newcastle making a very, very wise decision to stick with him and give him that sort of foundation and trust to build a very competing squad from here. I mean, their defense is just fucking incredible. They barely concede chances. Trippier has been amazing for them. Botman has been amazing for them. And then you have Almiron, who's been absolutely like fueled by what Jack Grealish has said. He's taken it like... He's taken it to every inch of his body, and like, he's taken it so personally. I don't think any manager of Newcastle United could have motivated Almiron to play so well as much as Jack Grealish has done for. So I think Newcastle owe Jack Grealish a lot.
the washing machine is spinning. The sports washing is working, boys. Everyone's loving Newcastle. Everyone's loving Newcastle. Yeah. Like, they've signed a few English, hardworking English football players. They have a brilliant British manager there. And, like, the media's lapping it all up, exactly what the man wants them to, like, think into. So, I'm loving this.
Yeah.
Everyone knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And, like, everyone's just waiting for that big moment where they're going to land. And I feel like they have, although it is sort of much earlier than I bet that they even would have expected them to, like,
even there. And that's because of Eddie Howe, because he's just coached this team fantastically. They are the best defensive team in the entire Premier League. They've conceded just 11 goals in their 18 games, which is just like, wow. And they have a very good defensive record, and just an overall record against the other top six, which I think is a testament to show that this is not some kind of fluke. They actually belong at this level, and they're playing pretty well. And the scary thing is that people like Isaac hasn't even had a go yet, and he is like one probably their marquee signing of their transfer window, right? And he hasn't even needed to be called. And even Callum Wilson was injured for a while and they were still purring along. So yeah, that entire team is built upon an extremely solid core. The goalkeeper, Nick Pope, like you guys said, Botman, Fabian Scher, Trippier has just been revelational.
Matt Ritchie, Ryan Fraser.
Ryan Fraser, Bruno Guimaraes.
Yeah, Guimaraes has been great. Maximin has had a very good season. I think he's injured now, right? He's not been featuring quite often for them. But he's he always is that X factor. Like, with someone like him in the team, it just boosts up the quality. So they are solid. They're defensively, they're excellent. We've been saying time and time again that for the Premier League, you need to be rigid to have a good season. You cannot be leaking goals. And they have all of those bases covered, and then they have some wonderful X factors and attacking talent in Saint-Maximin, in
Almiron.
I just took his name, Almiron. I'm very excited to see Mbappe play for them.
Come on, man, don't do this. But I think, you know, the transition period that we're talking about, the shift in like fortunes and towards what we talked about, the 2008-2009 Manchester City, where you could see the turn, like the change,
the
of
takeover.
Yeah, that happening. No, I think we saw it with the signing of Bruno, as well as that conversion of Joe Linton from an attacker to midfielder, man. Like, they've changed that midfield completely. These two have transformed them. Like, have from going from a midfield of Jonjo Shelvey and the Longstaff brothers to, like, these two, and then you add Willock over there. This is awesome. Like, dude, Joe Linton is too nice to see, like, as a midfielder. He's been awesome for them. And then you add Bruno G on top of that. Oh, that's awesome. And like with what Amar said about Almiron killing it, like he scored what, like 9 goals in his last like 12 or 13 games or so. That's an amazing return for somebody who had scored the same in his previous 150 appearances. So like, imagine that.
Yeah. Fueled. He's fueled by fire, man. Jackie boy really got to him. Do you guys think Newcastle finished top 4?
I think they do.
Nice. I think so too. And I would want them to. It's great for the city of Newcastle also, because I don't know if a lot of people know this, but Newcastle is one of the only few cities, like big cities in England, that has only one football club. So all of those fans are super loyal, super passionate. Every major city has at least 2-3. London has like 10. But Newcastle stands alone, and it's a huge, huge boost for the city if they come back into the Champions League, because they were one of the stalwarts of the English game before, and they have won the Premier League before. So they're not a Mickey Mouse
not
club.
Not the Prem, but...
Yeah.
It's not the Prem, I think they won the championship before. Bobby Robson and all that, yeah. They haven't won the Prem.
Okay. Let's move ahead. Manchester United, 17 games, 35 points, sitting on the same points as Newcastle, but with the game in hand. And Akshat is licking his lips. I know Akshat has been very, very excited about this season. Me, not as much, because I've invested so much of my emotional self into this club that I have very little to give away now. So I want to be extremely sure before I jump on that hype train and the...
I am here to make you sure, bro. Let's start. Yeah. Like, where do you want to start?
No, I'm already moving in the right direction. I just want to start off by saying, it's more than anything, it's very, very refreshing to see this United team with this kind of culture, camaraderie.
Yes.
The way we're playing, of course, on the pitch is secondary to what the spirit of the club is, the way Old Trafford is reacting, which I think for me is bigger than the way the team is playing, because... for the last maybe 5-6 years, Old Trafford has been very tepid. They've been quiet. They've been frustrated. You could actually hear the moans going out when fucking Schweinsteiger and Schneiderlin are playing their sideward passes. But now Old Trafford is loud. I think that Liverpool game was a big turning point in the change of atmosphere. We've been great at home, and then just the. As I said, refreshing, just the way Ten Hag has dealt with a lot of situations that previous managers have... I wouldn't say they made the wrong decisions, but that's where they faltered. in handling big egos, in letting players do as they like. It's been very loose, but Ten Hag has come and stamped that air of authority where he said that, okay, I'm here, I'm the boss now, and this is how we're going to do this. This is what we're going to do moving forward.
And none of that, like, none of that stamping authority, setting values, absolutely none of that works unless you prove on the pitch that you're winning. And that is what Ten Hag has done. He has got the buy-in from the players, as you say, where they know he's the boss, and they also have that belief that if they follow what he does, we're going to be successful. Because that's what's happened. He has, in such less time, instilled an identity in the way we play. An actual attacking identity, which God knows how long we've waited for. Even under Ole, when we were scoring bags of goals, we weren't dominating games, we weren't controlling games. We were hitting teams on the counter, amazing counters, but we weren't being how a big club should be, you know, in which you go into a game, you stamp your authority, and from minute 1 to 90, you are the more likely team to win, you are the more likely team to score.
Yeah.
And that is what Ten Hag has brought to United in a very short span of time. And I mean, we're nowhere near, you know, the levels which City and even Arsenal have, where it's like,
jinx.
Yeah, we are a
jinx.
Bro, we are your first foe. We're going to talk about Arsenal soon enough. But you can see, like, we are not there in the level of, you know, the stage of the progress. We are very far away from that. I'd say maybe in a season and a half, 2 seasons. But everything he's done so far has just been right. There's nothing I disagree with. I listen to his press conferences and they're just so perfect. He doesn't fluff. He doesn't say shit which he doesn't mean. It's direct. It's to the point. Everything I agree with. The way he's rejuvenated the career of so many people at Old Trafford, with De Gea suddenly looking like De Gea of old, apart from that one mistake he made in the FA Cup game.
Not Megan.
But Luke Shaw looking amazing. Aaron Wan-Bissaka looking actually pretty decent ever since the World Cup. We've had Fred putting in performances. And can we talk about the informed player in the Premier League? Rashford.
Going to say Casemiro.
I'll talk about the new signings later. But right now, I'm talking about like how he's got these players who are already at the club who are deemed, oh, fuck, they're phoning it in. They're not good enough anymore. To, you know, Rashford being fucking, what, 7 games in a row in Old Trafford, he scored now 5 games, all competitions. It's an amazing turnaround. And now talking about the signings he's made, Malacia has looked really, really good for us. Looks like a really good buy. Fucking Christian Eriksen has been beautiful.
I think 10 goal involvements all season. And
Yeah. And then we have, of course, Antony, who's very raw. Maybe we overpaid for him, but he's already, even though he's not played that much, he already has 5 goals for us. Lisandro Martinez, who's just transformed that fucking defense. And these 4 aren't even the best signing. You know, we have fucking Casemiro, who has looked every bit as world-class as he did for Real Madrid. And just that transformative effect of having a competent defensive midfielder in your team, you can see that at Old Trafford right now.
I think Akshat, in all honesty, and a lot of people might give flack for this, but I think Casemiro has looked better at United than he did at Real Madrid, simply because at Real Madrid, he had a Modric and a Cruz to do a lot of work too for him on the side. So what he's doing at United now, it stands out with the way he's dictating play. And it's just not, it's about how he reads the game, which is so good to watch. Like, he just knows when to press up, pinch that ball back, and his passes are so quick and slick and smooth that he just keeps United moving along. It's wonderful to see a defensive midfielder who's good on the ball too, you know, because we basically were playing 2 players for 1 position, which was McTominay and Fred, which was agonizing to watch because both of them were good in their own, like, 50% of... Defensively, they were good. On the ball, they were just boring.
Horrible.
They were flat. They offered nothing going forward. And I think Ten Hag in his recent press conference addressed this also, that United looked like a team before with like one team is a defense team, one team is an attack team, and I'm trying to get them all to play in one as a as 1-11. So
man, he just says everything right, he does everything right, the way, of course, we've spoken about the whole Ronaldo situation in entire episode, so I won't get into that. But yeah man, it's very hopeful. I feel for the first time I actually feel confident that we found the guy, you know, because I couldn't sit through three Mourinho seasons and then like the third season not being successful and be like, oh no, I have full faith in him. And Ole had a hell of a lot of deficiencies for as fun he was to watch as the United manager. With Ten Hag, I feel like this quiet confidence that, you know what, he will make us successful eventually, no matter what.
So, Akshat, we are 4 points away from City and 9 away from Arsenal, and those are the two games that we're playing next. If we get favorable results in both, do you say United are in the title race, or is that too far-fetched?
If we win both, then I'd say yeah. But I think, yeah, even like 4 points out of those two games might not be enough for me to... It does depend a lot on how we play, but I don't see us being there because we already have quite a considerable gap. And it's not like we're not playing well, and we have got great results against the top six. That City 6-3 is the only game we've lost against the top six so far. So it's not even like our results against them have been bad. It's just that I think there's already too much of a gap, and I think Arsenal are really just playing that well. I don't see them slipping up so much. So that's what makes like these games against these teams doubly important, which is why we need to plug that gap in these games. So unless we get 6 points, I personally don't see us in the title race. But I mean, it's just great watching us play nonetheless, you know?
Yeah. Let's move ahead. Manchester City, who've been... they are sitting on 39 points, 5 away from Arsenal, who are the league leaders, and they have a fucking monster in that team. I'm sure he's an AI footballer. He can't be human. Like, the amount of goals that he's scoring and just the ease at which he's scoring is crazy. But City have had their fair share of problems, man. They just look like... attack-wise, there's absolutely no issues, right? They have Bernardo Silva, Kevin De Bruyne, Erling Haaland. They even have Julian Alvarez, who they're not using, and he could come into the picture at any given stage now, considering the kind of World Cup he's had. But defensively, there are some issues. I think Guardiola found the formula, lost the formula, found the formula again, and again has lost the formula, because he's just changing so much at the back. I've not seen Guardiola play around with his defense, yes, but even his holding midfielder, who's usually Rodri, but now Rodri is playing like half centre-back, half defensive midfielder. It's strange to watch. Guardiola is a manager who never touches these positions. Like, if they're successful for a stint, then he continues to go on with the same bodies, you know?
But man's experimented too much up front, man. Like, this constant pairing of Mahrez and Grealish, I can't watch it. Like, after watching Sané and Sterling play there for them, and I can't watch Mahrez and Grealish play. It's like, the thing is, like, against City, you know, like 90% of the teams tend to sit back, like, they get into their shape, try to be as organized as possible. And you need those people, like, you can slice their way through past those, like, two blocks of four. But Mahrez and Grealish, they're the players who like to play in front of them rather than like go beyond and then like go past them and then go for the cutbacks that usually City like to play. So I don't know why he let go of Sterling this season, because I feel like he should have kept him, because like there's nobody else who can make those kind of like pacey run-ins behind like low blocks of defense. And I'm not sure like what Guardiola was going for. Maybe he has his reasons. Of course he does. But I think that is one of the reasons, even though they have one of these, like, the best number nine in the world right now playing for them, who's, like, going to blow all kinds of records of, like, goal-scoring records in the Premier League away, they're still, like, not what they were, like, a year or 2 years before that.
It's interesting you brought up that point of the wingers, because just in the game against Chelsea, Guardiola opted to start Cancelo on that right wing. which again made them go for a back three with, I think, RK, Stones and Walker. So Cancelo was essentially playing right wing for a majority of that game until Guardiola made like multiple changes. I think he changed the formation thrice in that game before they found the opening goal. So yeah, man, like he's now trying to experiment a bit too much to try and get the rhythm right for the final phase of the season.
And just to add to Po's point, what City do is that they dominate teams in terms of the way they kind of set you back, right? Like they dominate the space of the pitch, and having those wingers will push your fullbacks completely, pin them back, and that leads to that team not being able to get out and do anything against Manchester City. And now Mahrez has had a huge drop in form. And Sterling to Grealish, that transition really hasn't worked. And Sané, of course, that was a few more seasons ago. But these are the kind of wingers who we associate with City. And just to kind of see the difference in the impact, right? Riyad Mahrez last season had 11 goals and 5 assists in 28 games. So far this season in 12 games, he's had 2 goals and 1 assist. So far 3 goal involvements in the entire season. Raheem Sterling, who's not at the club right now, in 30 games had 13 goals and 5 assists, 18 goal involvements. They've lost that completely. Jack Grealish, so far, has had 4 goal involvements in the entire campaign, 1 goal and 3 assists. Compare that to Sterling, who was starting last season. So they have lost a lot of attacking threat from these wide areas. And Erling Haaland is definitely compensating for that in goal-wise. But what he can't do is that he can't compensate that in terms of styles of play. Because last season when they were playing this false nine and experimenting with that, they had another body to build up play.
Exactly. I was gonna come to that.
Yeah, and Haaland is very much not that striker. Even under Pep Guardiola, even under the system which City are playing, he's barely getting touches. Whenever he touches the ball, he fucking scores because he's a terminator. But that you can't compensate for that extra body in the build-up play and controlling the teams, you know. And I think that is what City have lacked this season. They're not able to control. Even possession, yes, they might have, but they don't control teams where they can't get out and they always look and find those openings. So I think Haaland is actually covering a lot of deficiencies in that team because he's just so good at scoring and finding goals. But City as a whole probably don't look as good as they used to.
That's the thing, no? Like, Haaland's ability to score compromises for those other lack of control. The control that you're talking about, the lack of that City have to compromise with, that evens out because of his number of goals that he scores for the team. It's sort of like a compromise that Guardiola had to reach to get in somebody like that. And the season before that, they went after Ronaldo and they were gearing for that kind of a systematic compromise as well. Like, if they had gotten Ronaldo back then.
Yeah.
The thing is, it only works because Haaland can convert those, get those insane numbers. Otherwise, it's the Aubameyang at Chelsea situation all over again that we just started off the episode with. So,
yeah,
it's that balance that you need to seek for, go for. And he's modified the team and those wingers, specifically all the players around Haaland to, suit his needs. To get, to ensure that Haaland can score the number of goals that he does, he's trying to put the players around him to facilitate that instead of trying to get goals from all around the team. So I think that is one of the factors, but City are not the same City as last season. Even though they're on pace to reach a 90 point beyond a season that's beyond 90 points, but they're still not the same, I feel.
Yeah. Let's move ahead and talk about the league leaders, Po. Are you ready for this? After how long have you been leading the league 17 games into the season? It's been a while, yeah? And Arsenal have been fucking fantastic. Leaving all the banter aside, they've lost only one game all season, which was against United. It was a great game too. And they could have taken something out from... Yeah, they could have actually gotten something out of that game. But... They've just been so fun to watch. They have all of these young talents who are seemingly gelling so well together. They have a very solid defensive shape. And when you have... So the four players that I want to concentrate on are firstly Saka, who's just been the highlight, I think, of this Arsenal squad hugging the touchline, you know, creating that width, and his dribbling ability has been outstanding this season. And we knew that about Saka from before, but the way he's just managing to ride those challenges, adding a more physical aspect into his game and moving the ball forward for Arsenal, I mean, what a fucking talent. And he did that for England also at the World Cup. He was great against France.
Saka had always had that technical ability, you know, like as you said, he's bulked up over the last 2 years. He's gotten that nonchalance around him, saying like, dude, you can't touch me, you can't get the ball out of me, like no matter what, like I can like get it past you. He can shield the ball however he wants, he can pass it back, or he can take his man on, turn him, like leave him like for dead, and then take him on, go beyond him. Like, everyone knows what he wants to do. Like, he wants to cut in, or like he's looking for that pass to Ødegaard or like Ben White at the back, or he's going to cut in for himself and then go like all the way to Martinelli, or like find a Jesus, or like find Nketiah now. But they can't stop him regardless. Like, they know that he's not going to touch like to the byline along the right hand side, like touchline there. He's definitely cutting in, and they still can't stop him to do that. So it's been amazing to watch. But I also feel like Saka is this Saka because of his versatility, like him being able to play him starting his career off as a left back and then transitioning to the right wing. He can play as a left winger as well. So like him playing all around the pitch, I feel like has given him this sort of like ability to like read the game properly and to do what is necessary of him in that particular game state. So I think it's all worked out like in his favor in that sense. And he's, as you said, he's had an amazing World Cup and in year. Like, it's like he's come back from the World Cup. Now he said like, listen, this is the Premier League, I know what to do here, I've come back from the World Cup, I was a joint top scorer for England with 3 goals there, I'm beyond this. It's I'm sort of getting that vibe from him right now. Like, I hope it lasts.
Yeah. Let's talk about your conductor, Martin Ødegaard, who's been, I think, my favorite player this season. Just the way he's moving the ball around. And I was actually reading the stat that he has the lowest dribbling rate in terms of numbers for Arsenal. Like, he doesn't dribble the ball as much, but one of the highest successful dribbling rates, that whenever he does dribble, he always gets past. I think it's like 72%. And he just ticks Arsenal along so well, and you know, this is, yeah, go ahead.
And that just speaks to good decision making, right? And for me, that is his best, according to me, that and the vision he has, those are his two best attributes, where he can see what's happening and he can always choose the best option, whether it is dribbling or whether it is picking out those passes. He's so good at beating that initial press, man. I just fucking love players who do that. When they can find, you know, the free man after beating one man.
Oh, that's awesome.
Not just him. I think all of the four which you are going to talk about, Amar, Saka, Martinelli, Ødegaard, and Gabriel Jesus.
Yeah.
All four of them.
No, actually, I was not going to talk about Jesus. I was going to talk about Zinchenko, but we'll come to that.
Oh, nice choice.
But the pose like at like a wine tasting, like, oh yeah, that's
yeah. Yeah. Like, this is better than the other one, bring it.
But for me, like, the point I was trying to make is that all of them are very, very good at both scoring chances and creating chances, because Arsenal are, I think, the second top scoring team in the Premier League, but none of their players are in the Golden Boot race. And that just tells you how good they are, because they're getting goals from everywhere. Any one of that front four will step up and score goals for that team. And all of them have like several assists also going into the season. So the fact that their attack is multifaceted makes it tougher for teams to stop them. And of course, let's not forget that they are a very good defensive unit as well. They're pretty much all their defenders are playing really well. Partey has been playing really, really well, even though he's an absolute asshole.
Scumbag.
But he's also been playing really well. So, I mean, yeah, if your defense is good, your attack is good, your midfield is good, then you're going to be a good team. And that's what's happened here.
Very, very sound analysis.
But I feel this Arsenal team is sort of like in line with Newcastle in terms of the fact they they both did not expect where they're going to be at this stage in their development in that progress, like to be one of the top teams in the world. I bet in Arteta's plan, this was much earlier than expected, similar to how Newcastle are third right now. And it's sort of all gelled, man. Like ever since last season's signings, where like Arteta has gotten like his hold of signings, and like the whole world was talking about Arsenal spending 150 million and it does not make any sense. I'm speaking to you, Gary Neville, when you say Arsenal have no plan in the transfer window. Screw that. Can you see it now? Like, can you see it now? Over the last 2 years,
let's talk about.
Over the last 2 years, we made those acquisitions. About, no,
he's not done, Amar. He's not done.
I thought he was done.
Carry on.
Over the last two years, we made those sort of acquisitions. No, like the sort of young, willing to fight for the badge kind of players who are like below their peak. I'd say, like except these two hard-headed motherfuckers in midfield and Xhaka and Partey. Everyone else is like around that. Like, just about to reach their prime or, like, below their prime. Yeah, early in their development. So, and, like, Arteta had this vision of what he wants each position of players to, like, do and, like, trying to fit that in. It's sort of similar to what City do. But it's that same philosophy of, like, controlling the ball, like, choking the opposition's defense and forcing them to make a mistake so that you can get past them and score. But it's at a different pace altogether than what City do. City are going after that slow poison, slow death, where this guy is, like, going for that hard choke, trying to kill you instantly. Like, that is what I feel it is, like. So, and he had this like outline for each position, what kind of players to bring in, and he's done that. Like, and I feel this goes a long way to how the board have backed him and all the like the hierarchy at Arsenal. I'm not talking about the owners because I'm still not fond of them. You can't like change my perceptions based on one good season about the owners, but like I'm talking about the people who actually work at the football club in terms of Edu, in terms of Vinay. And Arteta, of course. Like, so these three have, like, formed this core of, like, core that believe in each other and then have the same vision, no? Like, so that is what enables a manager when you back him for long enough to be successful. And I feel like Arteta is on the right way for that right now.
Yeah. I do want to bring up one point, which is in terms of style of play, Arsenal are the highest counter-pressing side this season, which has helped them so much to be where they are at the table, because teams just can't seem to get out when they're playing against Arsenal because they pinch the ball back so quickly. And I think that's Arteta's technical nuance and also the signings that he's made, which is why I wanted to bring up Zinchenko, which I think has been the most important signing for Arsenal this season, because he plays left back, but when they are with the ball, when they are in position, he moves alongside Partey or Xhaka, whoever's playing in that holding midfielder role, to make himself a midfielder. So what that does is it narrows the pitch down, it chokes the opposition, and that enables one of the three midfielders to go for that press and that counter press and get the ball back so quickly and then start rotating again. So it's very similar to what Guardiola does with Cancelo at City. I think that's where he's taken the inspiration from that. But he's been so pivotal in winning the ball back for Arsenal, and I think his presence on the field goes sort of unadmired, because I think he's extremely important in the way Arsenal are functioning right now, and then feeding those quick balls to Martinelli or Saka.
No, the way you put this, no, like, this is what enables Xhaka and the team to play as, like, with two number 8s instead of, like, 2 6s and one number 10. We've transitioned into that 4-3-3 team because Partey can hold the midfield all on his own, and two, Zinchenko comes in, like, as you said, like, and he becomes Partey's number, like, he becomes Partey's pairing over there. This has enabled Xhaka to go up, make those, like, bombing runs into the box that drags, like, a couple of defenders along with him, lets Gabriel Martinelli, like, cut in, or, like, Jesus slide towards the left, Xhaka come in, or, like, Odegaard to go through. Like, you have that bombarding run that goes, like, Xhaka's been doing, and this has actually yielded in him becoming like scoring quite a few goals from midfield. Like he's gotten his highest return ever at Arsenal this season. Like, and this season's barely 17 games in or 16 games in. You'd never expect Xhaka to be one of those players who'd get like consistently get a good run of games in with goals and assists. And like that transition from a six to number eight.
But you know what the funny part is, Paul? Like, Xhaka has always been that player for Switzerland who is more of an attacking-minded midfielder than what he used to do at Arsenal.
That is that. But the thing is, he's sort of that deep line number 10 at Switzerland. No, like, he's not like your out and out number 10 there. Like, he likes to sit in front of the defense and control the entire game on his own. Arsenal were trying to make him a holding midfielder, which is completely, now he's perfectly doing that advanced number 8 role where I'm honestly surprised with the way he's doing it. At least, you know, by doing this, this nullifies his worst ability. Like, the fact that when he's left when he's left one on one against the against the winger or against an attacker that's running at you, the man loses his senses. Like, so you put him up ahead in the field, like, and then do not leave him as the last man standing. This completely nullifies that option of him getting a red card as well. So I like what is happening.
Win.
Yeah, exactly. And he's a completely changed man. Zinny, by the way, before I close, like, Zinchenko, you brought him up. He is the best, like, person with technical ability in the team. Like, much better than Odegaard, much better than Saka, even Jesus. He has the best technical ability in the team. It's freaking awesome to see a left back with that kind of technical ability. And I don't know where this has come out of. Like, I always, like, when we were touted to sign Zinchenko and Jesus at the start of the season, I thought he'd be like more of a backup to Tierney, providing a different option. But man, this guy surprised me. Like, and it's a good, very good surprise.
Do you think Martinelli is going to be one of the Arsenal greats if he goes on like this, for sure? But you think he has it in him?
I don't know though. Like, it's that 21. I've seen a prime young Theo Walcott play as well, and he was much better than these two, I'd say. Like, he was definitely better than these two at the age of 19 to 21. And that turned out in a very bad way. I've seen Jack Wilshere play. He was definitely... I've seen Fabregas play, man. Like, at the age of 18 and 19. He was the youngest captain that we've had.
Bo has been heartbroken multiple times by young men. By strapping young men in the Arsenal kit.
No. Like, we have these two 21-year-old star boys up front for us, like, on either side of Jesus, who've been incredible this season, but I don't want to jinx it. Like, I hope both of them turn out to be turn out to fulfill their potential completely, what we expect them to, but I don't know.
Oh, very, very objective as you can get, do you think Arsenal are winning the title this season?
No. This is not because I don't want to jinx it or like bias or anything. I think it's too early for them to win the title. City are City, man.
Like, where do you think they slip up?
The thing is, I'm talking about, the last Premier League game was the best example for both the teams. Like, for my point, I'm saying both Arsenal and City were at halftime, they were nil all. Arsenal, the substitution that Arsenal had was one substitution. That was a right
substitute.
Yeah, that was a right back for a right back, and we bought on Tomiyasu. City got on like a fucking cavalry, and they managed to win the game 1-0. Like, it depends. Those game states, both were an identical game state, and City had the firepower to turn the tides in their favor. So
your next two games are going to be very decisive, because you're playing Spurs in the North London Derby, and then you're playing United. I wouldn't say, like, you might win those games, but it's not going to be a walkthrough, and it could easily define your season going forward from there.
But the thing is, looking at the way Arsenal play this season, I'm not afraid of any top six team, regardless of who they are. Ideally, the year last year and the year before that, the way we were playing was, we were setting up in two different ways, like against one sort of way against the rest of the rest of the league, and there was a defining way that we'd set ourselves out against the top six in like a sort of a defensive shell, two blocks of four, trying to have an organized defense, try to sit back in front of the ball. So we don't do that anymore. We take the game to the team.
Yeah, and you'd gotten absolutely schooled by City doing that. I remember that game. I think it was like 3-0 in the first 30 minutes or something like that.
But last season, the game against City, I think that is the defining moment where lots of people believed in Arteta, because we played City 2-2. Like, we took them on for the way they are, and we played with 10 men for around 30 minutes, I think, and then managed to concede the equalizer or the winning goal with Cancelo scored. No, Rodri scored. Somebody scored in the 90th minute. Yeah. So, but that game, even though we lost, we played incredibly well. And I think that is like the blueprint of how we've set out ever since. So I'm not afraid. I think we can. I'm looking forward to the City games, man. We haven't played City even once this season. That game got postponed. There are two games against City that are coming up very, like, there's the gap between them is not much, and they're later into the season. I think February 17th or 18th is the first time we play City. After, I think that'll be around, like, our 20th game, by the way. And that's sort of weird, though. Like, we should have finished one round of games by the time we're at 18 games, but due to fixture congestions and all that, it had to get postponed.
I just want to close by very quickly bringing up this point, is that after 17 games at this point of the season with such a large gap, there have been only 3 occasions ever since the Premier League has started where the team who's leading has not won. So I think it might not yet, but very soon it might be time to bring the trumpets out.
I hope so.
No, I don't think it's soon. I don't think they're going to win the league. Like, even if they do win the league, they're not going to win the league comfortably,
yeah,
because City are going to just be there at all times. So I don't think it's ever going to be a comfortable, like, oh yeah, fine, we can relax kind of a thing. I think it's going to be torture and heartburn and heartache for Poe throughout.
Akshat, do you think Arsenal are winning the title?
I would again say it's too early, but I would actually say right now at this stage of the season, both City and Arsenal have an equal chance, which at the start of the season was obviously not. But right now I'd say equal chance, which is still pretty significant if you ask me.
Yeah, yeah. And what about United?
I'm happy with what we're doing, bro. We are, like you said, we're level with Newcastle with one game in hand. We're going to, if we win that game in hand, we're going to be 5 points off Spurs from in fifth place. I'm like, progress is progress. That's it. We're going to get absolutely fucked with injuries, and we're not. We're going to struggle and somehow scrape our way in the top four. But like, it's okay. We're playing well, and that's all I
okay.
care about.
So then, quick predictions. I assume that you say that the top four is going to end with the way the top four is looking right now, with Arsenal, City, Newcastle, United.
I'd say Newcastle fourth, United third. But I wouldn't be surprised whatsoever if Liverpool end up fourth over Newcastle. But right now, I'd choose Newcastle. Yeah.
And Paul, what about you?
City, Arsenal, United, and Spurs.
Oh,
I think they're making it. They're this horrible, horrible. It's like they're this virus, man, that never let go of you.
Poor summer praising and.
No, the thing is, I know that they're gonna get in because, like, regardless of how shit they play, they managed to win games. So somehow.
Okay. Do you guys have any closing points, or should I wrap this episode up?
What about your prediction, like, for top six, whatever, top four, whatever?
Oh, my prediction. I think Arsenal win the title. City second, United third, and I agree with Akshat. I think Liverpool might sneak into fourth.
Nice. I hope your predictions come true, Amar.
just Po, if it happens, you're buying me a beer, bro. And
definitely
a dosa. Set dosa.
Dude, like, you can have as many beers as you want.
Okay, sounds good. I'll take this deal. Alright, listeners, thank you so much for getting to the end of this episode. We will catch you again next week. Until then, reach out to us on Twitter. Our handle is Pandit3andapint if you want to talk to any one of the four of us. And we will catch you very soon. Bye.